You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Nicole Havelka. The topic of the interview is how, once upon a time, Nicole had a job. She was very frustrated, and she made a very clear plan to quit the job and become a yoga instructor. Fast forward, that's not actually what happens. So, sounds like a simple conversation. Why even have the interview? But hey, wait a second. Things that seem simple can often be actually very nuanced and layered and complicated. Things that make this story interesting include the job Nicole had. You have to listen to find out what that is and what was causing the frustration. And then I rewind the clock and ask Nicole how she even ended up in that career path at all, which brings us to a conversation about faith, religion, and community. Now, those things can be hot button topics, but one of the things I do like to do on this show is to allow people a chance to talk about the stuff that can sometimes be controversial, but without it being controversial, confrontational, or partisan. And so I think you'll really enjoy that. And all of that comes back together, comes around in a circle, and we begin to unpack the decision that Nicole thought she was facing at that time, the decision that she made, and how it actually all worked out and what life looks like for her today. Now listen, that was a lot. One thing about this episode I'll be upfront about is that it's not short. That's just the way it goes. I think you're going to love it. So let's get to it. Nicole Havelka, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am very excited.
This is so good. All right. I start all of my conversations with my guests by asking them, what part of the world do you call home?
Right now I call Urbana, Illinois, which is in east central Illinois. I still can't say that very well. I've lived here for a year, so it's still relatively new to me. Before that, I lived in Columbus, Ohio for 9 years, and I've lived in Michigan and Iowa and other places too in the United States.
All sort of concentrated around the middle of the United States. Urbana the home of the University of Illinois? Is
correct.
That where that is? University
yes.
of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, yes, that's what we call it, right?
Correct.
I can remember the names of the schools. I don't have any connection to the university, but I do remember that that's the name. All right. So we're going to talk about the topic of the day in just a second, but I have one more warm-up question. I want to ask you, what is a recent compliment or words of kindness that you have given or said to someone recently? It can be something small. It can be earlier today, whatever comes to mind.
Well, what came to mind was earlier from just probably a few minutes ago. It probably wasn't even all that long ago. It was a little typed thank you that I put in Slack for with someone who helps me with graphics. I am at the time of this recording, I am like eyeball deep in preparations for a crowdfunding campaign for my upcoming podcast, which I know we'll talk about later. Someone who helps me make graphics, and they looked fantastic, and we're finally done with most of those, which is really exciting. And I'm ready to start scheduling social media posts and all of that jazz for the launch that's on in 3 days from now. Again, on the day
you
that we're
really
recording.
You really, really are eye deep. It'll be in the past when, in the funky world of podcast time juggling, this will be in
right.
the past when you hear it, when the audience hears it. But I love that. I have been asking this question for a couple of weeks, and I love the answers that I'm getting because there's a lot of pressure on people to, like, you know, random acts of kindness and get out there and be generous. But I think there's a flip side, which is to, like, validate ourselves that we are being gracious, that we are saying kind things, and that we're out there creating good stuff in the world. So thank you for sharing that. Topic of the day, not actually words of kindness. We're going to talk about a time when you became very frustrated with your work and you thought about throwing in the towel. These are all my words. It's not exactly how you described it. Your plan at the time was to pivot and become a yoga instructor, but that's not actually how it worked out. So I want to talk about the job that you had or have. So tell us about the job at the time that was driving the frustration.
The job at the time, excuse me, was I was working in the at the denominational level of the United Church of Christ. I'm an ordained pastor in the United Church of Christ. Most of my work, though, was at like sort of those levels of administration. So I was working for a regional body in Ohio that, or at least when I was hired, I thought they were farther in the process along of selling their camps. That ended up being really the whole 3 years that I was in that job ended up being consumed by the sale of one and later became both youth camps. That happened after I left. But there was much debate about which one would be the one to go, as you might imagine, and people had their loyalties one way or the other. I was hired to come in as at least on paper, as an innovator. And this was often the kind of jobs I got invited or I got invited into where, oh, we really need people to shake things up and change it, which was fine until there was too much blowback to whatever I was doing that was new. And so that, and I had already done this in other contexts a couple of times in different ways. And by this point, I was really done. So when that moment happened that I mentioned off pod, that moment that we're starting from, I was really, really tired. Not so much of the work. I actually really like it. I really like making new things, which is why I'm now an entrepreneur. Like I like making new things. I like building new stuff. I didn't like the resistance and the becoming a lightning rod for people and their fear, their anxiety, their grief, which again, I understand in my head, I understand intellectually is the way that we process that kind of thing, right? People and we're not always in a place like, and I've certainly offloaded, like my feelings on people when they probably didn't deserve it too. So it's happened to me. And it's gone both ways. But when you're the person like absorbing that all the time, it's really draining and exhausting at some point because I'm also a personality that really likes to do things and build things and actually finish them. And a lot of these places wouldn't let you do that because it was the new thing that I wanted to build. I wasn't interested in propping up the old one. And so that's where the criticism would tend to come in.
All right. So, what was going on? So, you had a job. You describe it as, I think, administrative is the word that you used. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm using exactly the same word. So, you have a job within this church, and what's causing frustration? How would you describe the baseline of the frustration that you were hired under a context that turned out to not actually exist, or they weren't really ready for you to do with what you wanted to do, or they didn't actually, it was unclear what was expected of you. What would you, now that you're on the other side of this, pretty much, how, if you had to describe what was the root cause of the frustration from your perspective in this last job, what was it?
That's a really good, that's an excellent question. I think the root cause ends up, and it usually ends up like later. It's usually fun for a while, the job, that these new kinds of jobs where they're like, oh, like we know we're set in this case, it was like, oh, we know that we're selling this camp and we want to make way for some new kind of programming. That's more sustainable and more innovative with families and youth. Like that was what kind of my charge was, among some other things.
So you were hired to create something new,
But
and then
really
they
what
weren't actually
people,
ready for that.
they were not. They weren't quite ready for that, partially because they ended up delaying the sale of one of the properties for a couple of more years. Which was most of the time that I was there. So part of it was just there was res like that really didn't have anything to do with me. There was resistance to the sale of either camp. And then when even they said, well, we have to sell one but not both, like then there was infighting about which one. So again, that wasn't necessarily directed, that kind of stuff wasn't directed right at me because I didn't have much to do with or any control over that. But what they really wanted my position, certain people really wanted my position to be, oh, you're here to really improve and market the, at that time, the one camp that was running. Like it
Okay.
was still running for stuff. They wanted me to do that. And so I was getting tons of pressure from certain people to be that person, which I told them in the interview. I said, if you want someone to run your camp, you should hire someone else. I
All
literally
right.
said those words out loud. So I
So
said, if you
yeah.
want that, that's fine, but there's plenty of people for that. I'm not it. And then, but I think some of the my immediate supervisor and some other people in a smaller circle did want the innovative thing, and they are willing to, so they were willing to support it to a point. And then either they got worn out, which is totally understandable, or just the resistance is too much. And so there's less and less of that support for what needs to be done over time.
Yeah, so in almost every situation where there's frustration, resentment, anxiety, apprehension, there's more than one thing going on that snowballs into it. And one of the things that can very frequently be true is that in the moment, like in the moment when you're living through it, it's not actually clear what the causes or the things that are driving the situation are. And then one of the things that can happen sometimes is like you come and you mention this that it wasn't up to you. You can find yourself in a spot that is unpleasant, unfamiliar, unlivable, unworkable, but it's not really up to you, and out of your control. And that doesn't, in my experience, that doesn't feel great either. All right. So if it's okay with you, I want to back up a little tiny bit and talk about how you came to have this particular job at that church, like, and talk about, like, so it sounds like this is a type of job that you searched out intentionally. So how did it come to be that you were hired? What was the job description sort of like? Like, how did you come to be in this position in a church?
Oh my gosh. So
And
this is
I'll stop. One of the reasons I want
sure.
to give a chance is I think that there are people out there listening that have probably never stopped to think about the fact that an organization like a church hires people and posts jobs. So that's one of the reasons that like that you know that I've thought of this question. So tell us about
Right.
that process.
Well, I mean, if you want to get super church nerdy, you can say it depends on the denomination you're in. So, in some like that are more hierarchical, like United Methodists or Episcopals, there is a bishop that appoints people if
Okay.
you're clergy in particular. In our denomination, it's very top down. Like, so each setting of the church, including local churches, and then these denomin like these wider church bodies, they're usually, in this case, it was sort of, well, it was mostly Ohio, but part of West Virginia and Kentucky as well. We had a little chunk of that. So they hire on their own. So our stuff is all, and we have a place where within the church they post those jobs. That
Okay.
is legitimately a thing. So if you rewind maybe 10 years before this, I actually, one of my first jobs out of seminary was as a chaplain at a residential treatment facility for children and youth with mental illness and behavioral disorders. I had
Okay.
done that for a few years and loved it, and also burned out on the institution, not the work itself. So it was a similar pattern, but not quite. No one knew at that institution, no one knew quite what to do with the chaplain because that was a relatively new position. It was similar dynamic. It was in a very different setting, but I had done youth work. I had done a lot of stuff around youth and young adults, and found myself becoming a really big advocate. And I would still say this is true, even though it's not forward in my work anymore, that I still care very deeply about young people being included in organizations and institutions. So I did that for a few years, and then I was like, okay, I'm kind of done here. And then I started looking at just what was out there. Like, I really didn't have a really clear vision of what that might be.
Okay.
But I do remember at the time, so at the time I was under 40, and I had hung out with some other young clergy groups. And I really had a vivid memory of one of my kind of now friends and colleagues. Both of us have aged out of being under 40 now, but he had said in one of the groups we were in, he's like, don't count yourself out for those jobs that are in the denominational, like in the wider church, in the larger denominational body. Because even if I say on paper the kind of experience they want, they may still be interested in you. Like,
Okay.
don't Don't sell yourself out. And he's like, so what does it hurt to apply? Well, I happened to be looking just generically at what might be open. And I saw that in the at the time, the Iowa Conference of the United Church of Christ had just created a new, they called it an associate conference minister for youth and young adult ministries. So it was a position specifically for working with youth and young adults. And I was, by the standard of working for that kind of, most of the people were definitely white males in their, at the time, in their 50s and 60s wouldn't were the only ones for the most part in their job. There were a handful of women here and there, but mostly older white men. And I applied for this youth and young adult position, and I was like the ripe age of 34 or something like that. Maybe 35, I can't remember. But I was sort of in my early to mid 30s, but I was like, I was sort of hearing what my friend Mike had said, and I was like, okay, I guess I'll give it a shot. I applied for the job, and it went like crazy, and I got that job. And I actually loved it, loved it, loved it. I won't even tell. Some of it was resistance. That position after 5 years was eliminated, at least on the surface, for financial reasons. I would argue that wasn't the only reason, but that position was eliminated.
I'm still over here enjoying that there's a group for young clergy, which like,
There
I
is. There
like that. I
was.
think
It still, I
it's,
should say,
I'm
was. It
sure.
still exists. I'm just too
I
old for it
mean,
now.
it makes total sense. I just had never thought about it, I just had never thought about it as being a thing. All right, so you do that job, and then so you again are looking intentionally within the church community for jobs that are open to you. That's how you, so it was intentional looking for that. Okay.
Yeah, and so then after that, it was really what I what when that position was eliminated for again, I didn't feel like I was done with that work at the time. It was eliminated sort of before I really felt like it had gotten all the traction it could have gotten with the vision that was starting to spring up for me. So I started seeking out ways to continue living that vision out. Like
Okay.
over time, the piece around youth and young adult ministry kind of fell away for me over time. Not because I didn't care about young people, but because like I just got interested in other things like this, because of how much resistance I faced in these things, like the ideas about organizational change. I read everything I could for a while on organizational change, organizational psychology, people make, just ideas about change and theories about change and how groups make it. And so like for and I just love thinking about systems and how they work or they don't, or the cultures of places. And so I got really into that. So it was just that I got really into those kinds of questions. And so I think that's part of why I even so when this and I honestly wasn't sure what I would be doing. I took a job. It was just a part-time job in Michigan for about a year and a half. It was the more traditional job, which I quickly get bored with. Like that is just not what I'm, again, maintaining things as they are is just not my jam. I started looking after only about a year and a half because I was sort of promised that we might move in a different direction, and that was clearly not happening. I didn't live on bad terms. Like, I really liked the people I worked with, but it was just not a fit for me anymore. And then this job came up in Ohio, which was a short-term position, so I knew it was going to be, ended up being 3 years, but it was originally contracted as two. And it was, the title was something like Minister for Innovation and creativity. I don't remember the whole title. I have it on my resume somewhere. And I kind of helped make up the title actually, because we were like, what do we put on a resume? What do we say I'm about in order to signal that this is something new? And so that was really exciting. There were people involved in that I was really excited to work with, people who were really, I thought that I knew of. I didn't know them personally, but people I knew that were kind of had reputations for being innovators. So I was really excited to go there and work. And then I met the same kinds of resistance there that I did in other places, some of which wasn't surprising to me. But then it gets support. I think what really gets, if kind of going back to your first question, which is I think part of what gets frustrating, is not so much that there are people resisting you, but that the people who hired you to do the innovation start backing off of it and quit supporting you. That's probably the part that's the most frustrating, because the resistance, especially once I started doing reading and understanding organizational change or change in general, like resistance is just normal. It just is what it is, and it is exhausting. But if you have the right kind of supports, it's not nearly as bad as it could be.
I hear that a lot from people who are coming from academia, that it comes down to whether or not there is enough structural support to support you in that role. So I want to recap this because there's a lot of interesting things that you laid out in your process to get this job. And one of the things that I heard you say that I think is relevant outside of your own experience and helpful for people listening is that there was a time where you were not clear on what you were doing, and you talked to the people around you, some friends who encouraged you to think bigger, and you tried something new, and that part of the process led to clarity and a vision that you are working towards finding things that match that vision, and you found your way to this job with a title that you helped create that really felt like it matched what you were trying to do. And but in 3 years, it became very frustrating. Okay, so now I'm going to zig a little bit in the conversation and bring we've actually been doing this already, but I'm going to bring it right to the front of this. So religion can be a very hot button topic. A lot of people solve, not in this conversation, but sometimes. And one of the things that can happen is that people solve the problem of the fact that it's a hot topic by just not talking about it at all and just having a super vague, super vigorous conversation where we hint and innuendo and all of those things. And I get it. I totally understand that. But in this case, I don't want to do it, and I don't think we have to. I find it confusing if you're listening and you're like trying to figure out like what are they actually talking about? And so you are an ordained minister. You've told us the name of your congregation and the denomination and those kind of things. And I want to give you a chance to talk about like your faith and the faith community and how important it is to you, was, is, all of those things past and present.
Oh my goodness, that's a great and broad question. I love
I
it.
can narrow it down if you
No, it's
want, but
okay. It's okay. I mean, here's the thing. For those of you who are listening to this who are like, the church, I don't want to hear anymore, like really hit, like just listen for another couple of seconds. Like, I probably have all of the same feelings you do about the institutional church, having been in it, because I have the same misgivings. So the short version of my faith history is that I was raised Roman Catholic. My family was very religious. I went to Catholic schools from 1st to 12th grade, where I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. And when in high school, I had sort of a falling out of faith in large part because the diocese closed my first high school after my sophomore year. Like, as a, as an institutional
sure.
choice, And now, as an adult looking back on that, I get why they needed to do that. Like, there were like 200 students in a building built for 2000. Like, it was not sustainable. Like, what was happening there was not sustainable. And honestly, if someone had actually bothered to have a conversation with me, I probably could have understood it at least to some extent as a 15-year-old. Maybe not all of the big picture stuff, because I was a teenager and I was just sad that my high school was going to go away.
Right. How dare they?
How dare they? And that's how
Yeah.
we all felt,
100%.
that. And so I had to
You're
find another
dead to
high
me.
school to go. You're dead to me. Exactly. And honestly, like that experience, I think I'm actually super grateful for that experience now, because I don't think I would have, if I'd stayed in the same high school, if I had not had that disruption, like I would have been, I think, less likely to have gone away to college, which I did, just because I had that sort of uncom and then I had the experience of going to another high school where we weren't, like, not just me, but a lot of the people who transferred in from my school were not exactly welcomed with open arms. I
Okay.
mean, some were and some weren't. It was sort of a mixed bag, but like,
Did you transfer to another Catholic high school?
I did.
Okay.
I did. And my parents actually let me have the choice. I could have gone to a public school at that point, which I had wanted to when I started. Like when I started high school, I wanted to. They would have let me go, and I was just having a particular experience at the other school that made me wanted to continue with a
Okay.
smaller school, smaller Catholic school. Not necessarily because of the religion piece, but because of the opportunities I thought I would have there.
Okay.
To do, I was a theater kid and a speech team kid and that kind of thing. And so I thought I would have, I was excited about the opportunities at that other school, which ended up being true to, for the most part. I did have the opportunities to do things there that I probably wouldn't have at like a bigger school with more competition. On the other hand, it was a socially a pretty miserable experience, because you weren't welcomed. It was hard to fit in and make friends when everyone else had been friends or knew each other, in a lot of cases since elementary school, because
Yeah.
that particular school had an elementary school that fed into it. So those of us who were outsiders were really outsiders. Like, so
Sometimes
that
it's funny.
disrupted my faith life in a big way. And I said, screw the church, I want no part of it, and didn't do it for a very long time. So I mean, I
Is
had
such
to
a
go to
classic teenage reaction. It's like, you
very,
didn't
oh my
carry my
God.
soda. I'm never coming to your store again.
Exactly. It's so true. So at 16, I was like written off the church as a whole, like it was, you know, as a wholesale thing, which of course there are many th like the church is a very broad thing and a very
Yeah.
large thing. So I did that in my early 20s. I went to a college that intentionally went to a college that had no religious affiliation.
Okay.
And went to a small liberal arts college that I absolutely adored. I'll give a shout out to Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, because
There
it's
you
a great
go.
little school. And I'm still a big supporter, and I do a lot of volunteering with them today. And it was such a tremendous growing experience for me there. And again, they weren't overtly, there actually was some religious affiliation to their founding,
Right,
but
which is
they were
often the
no
case,
longer
yeah.
affiliated, which is true for most of those small schools,
Yeah, a
but
lot of
the
schools are they're either founded by land grants, like state schools, or you know, who else is going to start a university? It has to either be like a gazillionaire or a faith group. You know, that's
Right.
the you know, even if and then they can grow out of it, you know, but they might have roots that's like these are the people who started it, and
Right.
now we've moved, we've been able
Right.
to
Right.
separate. But yeah, somebody has to give
Yeah.
the land and the buildings and.
Right. Somebody's got to bankroll all of that. And at
Right.
the time, like I learned, I actually didn't learn this until I went to seminary, but like that many of these smaller schools were started as a way to educate clergy.
That makes sense. So
That they
you,
were like,
yeah.
including I what we know as Ivy League schools now were started for that reason.
So yeah, well, and when so I've got four kids, I've gone through the school process four times. I've done more college tours than probably anybody needs to do. But yeah, you'll walk through the small liberal arts schools, and they're centered around, even if they're non-affiliated, they're often centered around a chapel or a temple. And so then you learn that the story of the first people and the first donation and so on and so forth. And sometimes it holds true forever and ever. And other times, you know, there's a later a separation or an inclusion or all of those things. The school that's coming to mind, so I'm in Florida, Eckerd, which is on the west coast of Florida, small liberal arts school. And right in the center, they have a chapel that is, it's, I don't even think it's used as a chapel anymore, but it was. So when you were talking about that, I was like, oh yeah, that strikes with my 927,000 college tours that I've done. So you did a college degree and then you later went back to seminary.
I did.
These are two separate educational experiences. So faith is, so your personal faith is definitely a an important part of you that has held through your life and has gone through some evolution. The second part of that is about community and being a part of the faith community. You talk about leaving that in high school, which is one of my favorite stories today. I love that. Did you come back to seeking a community based around faith for yourself?
You know, when I was in my mid-20s, I jokingly refer to this as like my midlife crisis. When I was like mid-20s,
Well, now
I
we'd call it the
graduate
quarter life crisis,
the
yes.
quarter life crisis, whatever that is. Like, it's really just young adulthood. I don't know that it's a crisis. And now I would be like, oh, that's just what young adults do. I
Yeah, don't
wouldn't.
do that with your with a young adult. It really helps them if you take
No,
their challenge
don't let
seriously.
go, right? But when you're older, you're like, oh, that's just how it is when
No,
you're 25.
you
You're
gotta
figuring it
practice it.
out, you're practicing, you're figuring out, you're learning what fits and what doesn't, and that's normal. So I actually started my career as a journalist. So I was working at newspapers in the Chicago suburbs. When I first graduated from college in the mid to late 90s, I did that for about 5 years. I also became disillusioned with doing that work. Again, not because I hated it, because I actually did like a lot of parts of being a journalist and still do. I don't feel like I've ever completely gone away from those, from doing the kinds of things that a journalist does. I don't think I've ever lost that entirely. But I was just growing disillusioned with it in part, or at least the part that that I remember as being the most uncomfortable was that as a journalist, your job is to observe and write stories. You're always an outsider
You're supposed to
with
be the
that.
outsider, right?
And that's you're supposed to be an outsider. That's breaking down a little bit now. That was also like more than 20 years ago. Well, 30 years ago now. That wasn't breaking down quite so much as it is now, I think. You're supposed to be this outsider. You're supposed to be, you're generally speaking not involved in the things that are happening, and that's okay for some things. And then I was just frustrated that like, there's all this suffering that I observe, and I can't do anything about it. Like, it's not my role to do something about it, even though, and I'll just do this as a caveat, that I really believe strongly that bearing witness to those things, and this is really, really true in the world we find ourselves in right now, right? Being a journalist, someone who bears witness to those things and tells its story is really, really important, I think. But it didn't feel, and so for those of you who are journalists out there who are doing it, please keep doing that good work. It didn't fit me. Like, I wanted to be someone who was taking action around things, and I didn't even have a specific thing, even necessarily, that I wanted to be acting about. I just knew that this wasn't fitting me anymore. So initially, I was pivoting to, this was very common for journalists to pivot to doing like public relations work. And so I started applying for jobs, and this was in the late 90s, for jobs at nonprofits doing sort of PR, marketing kind of jobs. And there was two or three times when I was the final, like one of the two finalists for a job, and I didn't get any of them. And that was super frustrating. And again, this was in a pretty booming time in terms of the economy. So there were quite a few, there wasn't a lack of jobs to apply for that would have fit my sort of level of experience. Especially then, I had like 5 years professional experience and a bachelor's degree. So that was decent. And I wasn't getting, and I got really frustrated. I should also mention that at like kind of overlapping that, I had this weird inkling to go back to church that really came out of nowhere. You'll sort of notice that I have a lot of intuitive moments that sort of guide me. I'm far more planned and strategic now, but like I'm less so now, but I still do listen to those energetic pings, if you will, those sort of things that are drawing me, whatever you want to call it, the universe, energy, God, whatever you want to call that. Like those sorts of drawing things for me, that's still really important to me, but I wouldn't say skeptical about it, but I'm also more strategic about it than I used to be. But so when I was younger, so at that point, I had this urge to go back, and it just so happened that a coworker of mine in the newsroom I worked in went to his church, which was a United Church of Christ church. I didn't know that from Adam. I had been raised Catholic, and when you're raised Catholic, especially when you're so immersed in it like I was, like it's like Catholics and then everybody else, like all of the Protestants are like some big generic blob to you. Now I have a understanding that's far more nuanced, but at the time that's all I understood. And I really, he talked and he was not like in your face about it at all, but it's just what he did, because he's like, oh, well, I'm going, and he was like in their handbell choir, like I have rehearsal tonight, or I'm doing this for my church, or I'm going on this youth retreat, because he did chaperone stuff and things like that. And we made fun of him actually in the newsroom. We're still friends, so I'm going to send him this podcast since I'm mentioning him. We talk about this all the time. And we still mention this every once in a while. And so he talked about it. And so then when I had the inkling to go back to church, I literally sat myself down in his office, or maybe sent an email, but I'm pretty sure I just went in his office and I'm like, "So, Brett, I'm thinking of going to church. Like, would you mind if I went with you sometime?" And he looked like, fortunately, was deadpan enough, even though I'm sure he was like ready to fall out of his chair. And he was really receptive. He's like, "Oh, sure. Like, I'm not here this week, but I am here like on this week if you want to come with me." And then he also said, "Oh, but there's kind of a church light. We're having a service in the park like once a summer." So it was probably around this, we're recording in early
In
August.
early
So
August, yeah.
like it was probably around that sort of late summer time that he said that. And he's like, "If you're comfortable going by yourself, like that's a really chill sort of way to go hang out." And I felt really drawn and led back. And so
Yeah.
eventually that became the congregation where I was ordained 5 years later.
All right. So this may seem like a pretty big veer off of the topic, but I think that it's helpful to understand and to give a platform for people to explain their own personal experiences about. I mean, this is a conversation that not a lot of people are having, and I don't have it's like a place to let that be. So you were working in the church, so on and so forth. You've shared a lot about your life, your experience. I know you a lot better. I want to ask you one very pragmatic question when it comes to working for the church, because I think this will be really fun. When you choose, you go to seminary, and you're working for the church. What are the salaries like when you're looking to be an employee of a church? Like, was when you were working for the church as an administrator, is this enough of a job that you did not have any economic pressure in your budget? Were you able to just like live and have a nice life in your last job? Like, I think of the most famous jobs that go along with churches are known for their respect for either abject poverty or extreme wealth. Those are the two stories we see.
Right. Yeah, and both of those stories exist within my denomination because we don't have a ton of really, really large churches, but we do have a few of those where their senior pastors would make pretty like six figures anyway. None of them probably make in the like go to seven. Like that's
Okay.
not a thing that happens in our denomination. That happens with other places, but not for us. I would say that I was like, I didn't now, this is me now kind of understanding money better than I did at the time. Like I would say for the most part, these positions are really underpaid. And that was true though when I was a journalist as well. Like a starting journalist, I had to have extra jobs in
Okay.
order to survive. And that was a little less true when I graduated from seminary, although I would say that it was, but then when I graduated from seminary, I had more student debt than when I
Okay.
before, even though I had really, again, I had been out of school long enough. I had been out for 5 years. I knew what it was like to repay loans. So I was really like, did as much as I could to minimize the amount of debt I took out. And I have very had, have and had very little compared to a lot of people. But I still had extra. Now I had a bigger payment to make on student debt. And during seminary, I again, because partially because I was trying to work and go to graduate school, that was a huge financial struggle. And then I ended up with a lot of credit card debt coming out of graduate school. And then spent time being really poor and paying that down as best I could with my first job, which was paid okay, I guess, but not enough to like deal with the mountain of debt that I had. Like it probably would have
Okay.
been fine if I didn't have the debt, but it wasn't. And that has basically remained true my entire life. So
Okay.
the positions I had at the denominational level were sort of adequate to live on, I would say, for the most part, but they're not making you wealthy.
Okay.
Let's
And
be clear
then,
about that.
all right. So the part of this story, like, so you become frustrated with this denominational level job, the frustration. And one of the reasons that I started talking about the money involved is that at some point in here, you are, I guess, Are you going to a local yoga studio that offers teacher training? But something comes in your mind that what I'm going to do is I'm going to become a yoga teacher. And I wondered whether or not this was partially like it was, the initial idea was I'm going to, it'll be a side hustle, it'll be something else. And so that's what I was thinking was like, you know, was this kind of thing. So how did the yoga part enter this discussion?
Well, that happened like parallel to everything that happened like postgraduate school. So there was a lot of conversation when I was in seminary, which is a graduate degree. Like that's getting a
I
graduate
did not
degree.
realize
So
that
the
until you
people,
started
those are
saying
the
that.
same
Yes.
things.
Yeah.
At least with us, that's true. You're
Okay.
getting a master's degree. The denomination has its own process for ordination. And this is less true now because they've changed the rules a little bit. But for the most part, for a long time, getting a Master's of Divinity was one of the one big requirement toward ordination. But they actually make you do other things as well. It's not the only thing, but it's the biggest and most expensive thing, as you might imagine. It took me 4 years
Okay.
to do that degree. I did it part time for 2 years, and then I was full time for a couple of years. But there's a lot of field work involved, which makes it very, very time consuming. 3 years is minimum. And most people take 4 or 5 at least to finish it, or longer if they're working other jobs, you know, like full time or very, very nearly full time jobs. So it's not an easy path to take, whether you're straight out of college or mid career. I'm
So how did you
sorry.
get to
Wind me
yoga?
back to the question. I'm sorry.
How did yoga come into the story is
Yoga,
the
of course. So part of in seminary, we were talking a lot about how do you take care of yourself in order to be present in the way that you need to be for people, as you're serving a congregation or people in the community or whatever you feel like your call is. And so we talked a lot about that. And I had a number of friends who were sort of daily or at least regular meditators or pray, you know, had prayer practice, contemplative practices of one sort or another. And at the time, that did not fit me at all.
Okay.
I had done a little bit of yoga like prior to that, like when I was younger. I had actually been exposed to it when I was in high school at a theater camp. And then later I sort of sought it out when I was still a journalist. That was a time when it seems crazy now, but at the time you couldn't, studios weren't all over the place like they are now. That was in the late 90s. There you would find one or two yoga teachers in your area, and that was about it.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
I'd taken a few classes, which I enjoyed, and then so but then I didn't do it during graduate school, and then I went to and then after I graduated, I'm like, well, I have to find something. Well, yoga is like this was literally what I thought. Like, well, yoga is a moving meditation, right? I'll do that.
All
So
right.
that'll be my thing. And it became my thing. About 3 or so years in, when I was still working with young, at-risk youth at the treatment facility, I did my first teacher training. So I had already done that. I had
Okay.
finished that first one at the end of, I finished that in 2008, I think it was. And that was right at, I finished that right at the time when I switched to doing this denominational work.
So when you're doing the denominational work, you're qualified as a yoga teacher. Are you doing yoga classes on a semi-regular or occasional basis and or not really?
Occasional, you know, I really had gone into that. I mean, well, I should preface that. When I was still doing the teacher training, I did teach regularly with the young people in residential treatment. Like that was, so there were a few, cottages is what they called them. They had like, they were residential, so they had kids living on campus with, I went to some of the therapists who were really like open to what I was doing. And I said, hey, do you want to try this? And so there were a couple places I was teaching there. That was when I was still doing my teacher training. And then I had did it used it a little bit with young people that I had like one-on-one convert, you know, I had some that I met with regularly, the one-on-one, I would do that. And then then when I got the denominational job, it just became hard to have a regular class, even
Okay.
as just a fun side thing, because I traveled a ton. So I was constantly on the road. It was very difficult to do anything consistently, but then people would find out that I could teach yoga. And so if I was like going to a conference, let's say, like some sort of training conference or something like that. People would say, oh, you can teach yoga. Do you want to teach a class? And they would ask you to teach the 7 a.m. class that like three people at best show up to. So I just FYI, I don't teach that 7 a.m. class at a conference anymore because it's just too much for people at those conferences. They've generally been out too late hanging out with their friends to get up for a yoga class. Which is totally fine. I'll do it more integrated into a bigger program. So, or I would integrate it into, I was doing a lot of teaching and training by this point. So I would integrate it into what I was teaching and training. Like we might do a breath meditation in part of it, or I might do some stretching as a break partway through a thing. And I still do that because I still think it's really important. So that's how that was happening. And then I was a probably the most important use of yoga though for me was that it was sort of my way of holding myself together in all of that stress I already described. So like I my yoga studio was my oasis away from that, and I kept for a decade kept those worlds extremely separated.
And so there's a time where your thought is, I need to quit this denominational job and I'm going to be a full-time yoga teacher. Was that a singular moment in time where you were sitting on your couch and you're like, hey, this is the answer? Or was it something that bubbled up over time, slowly?
It probably was bubbling up a little bit, but I remember it as sort of a thing that kind of happened suddenly. So I went to my day off at the time was Friday. You work weekends when you work for the church, so you have days off that aren't normal. So I had a Friday was my day off, and one of the things I did, I was living in Columbus, Ohio at that point, and I had a yoga studio that I just loved, and there were two classes on Friday morning that I would go to back to back. One was a meditation class and the other was a movement class. And I went in with that attitude one morning and I just said, I am done. I don't even remember what happened that
They
precipitated
said,
that.
set your intention, and you were like,
My
I'm quitting
intention
my
was that I
job.
am freaking done with this, with what I'm doing. I'm so done with these people. And then that's sort of my intention. Like, I don't know. That's not a great intention, really, but like, whatever. It worked, actually. So I went in with this frustration. And I don't even know what happened in those classes. I couldn't tell you anymore. But like, what came up for me as I was walking out was this was like a really clear voice in my head was, what if it's not either or, but both and?
Okay. And that's the shift that happens,
That's
right?
the massive shift that happened. And
Yes.
so I started, this was sort of it be then it, that was sort of magical in a way. Like then I started offering to teach and offer these, like this thing I'd sort of done here and there. I started offering intentionally, like we were facing the final votes for that camp controversy I was talking about,
Yeah.
right at the time I had this thought. And I sent an email to our board chair, who was going to have to chair the next two meetings, which were going to be hard meetings. And I said to her, I said, hey, I had this thought, basically don't worry if it's not something you don't want, because I really thought they'd say no. I sent them an email saying, hey, I had this idea. What if I led some grounding, some breath work, grounding practices, and some community building before these meetings that are going to be really hard? I mean, she emailed me back probably within the hour saying, yes, that's a great idea. Which I was like, okay, then I
Yeah,
guess we'll
because
do
you're
it.
in, yeah.
Right? Then I was like, all right, I guess this is what we're doing. And so that sort of began the experiment of integrating, bringing in that stuff that had been very, very separate for me from my church world and bringing that in. And it made that the it, that absolutely made the ending of that so much better. And not
Okay.
because the end result was it all different. They sold the camp because they were going to need to sell the camp. But I feel like people had more productive conversations, people had better relationships coming out from it, and people, the tone was better in terms of the conversation than it had been prior to
So
that.
I'm going to take you back to high school you, who had a negative experience with them closing your school and made a just a knee-jerk, like absolute black and white decision about how you were going to feel about that. to many, many years in the future, you think you have a black and white decision in your head. You walk into a room and you're like, this is over, I'm not doing it. But you walk out of the room with the awareness that the two things might be able to coexist and work together. If there's somebody in the audience who's listening who feels like they have a very black and white decision in front of them, they feel like they're in a spot where they have to make an either or choice. Based on your experience in moving through this, do you have any guidance or tips to say, if I was to try and do this on purpose, how do you open yourself up to seeing, can these things work together?
Have a spiritual practice, whatever that looks for like for you. Because I think, yeah, even more so after that moment, like I now go to my practices to help me make those kinds of decisions.
There it
It sort
is.
of happened, like I would say those sorts of things happened in heightened emotional moments or whatever, I would turn to those things. And
Yeah.
now also, my like yoga and meditation practice is just a daily thing now,
Yeah.
and that has been true for a long time, but it has maybe a different intention. And then I did that with the formation of what is now my business, which is birthed out of that moment, out of that both and moment, which was probably 7 or 8 years ago, at least, maybe longer. I'm losing track of time. It was probably longer than that, a long time before that. So I had that inkling, that idea of what this next thing. So I did, after that moment, I did pretty quickly after that sign up for a 300-hour and advanced yoga teacher training. I got attuned to do Reiki, which is an energy healing practice, which I'm attuned to do now, and did a bunch of stuff. A bunch of advanced training at the yoga studio I was at the time, as a
If I
way,
had a
partially as a
hundred
way to
bazillion,
explore what I was going to do next, because I didn't know what it looked like.
if I had $100 bazillion, which I do not, and endless time, I would want to do a survey of all the humans in the world and find out how many ordained pastors have gone on to get a Reiki certification. Because I think that would be a really,
At
really
least in our
interesting.
progressive circles, a lot is the
I just think it would be a really interesting
answer.
data field. Like, I don't know if anybody's like researched it, and I just think it would be a lot of fun. I'm not sure it has any practical application, but it is, it does, you're a person who represents that these things come together in perhaps unexpected ways. It would be really
Right.
interesting. I could expand it and be like, how many rabbis and priests and all of these things. I would
Sure.
super, su I like how many, like, I think it would be a fabulous, fabulous question. So, what does your life look like today? Because you are like, I don't like, so what do you do? And I know you've talked about it a couple of times. We're going to wrap up in a minute with my final fun questions, but tell us what you do today. Tell us about the upcoming podcast and how people can find you.
That's so exciting. So what I do now, we're of course running out of time. So there's been an evolution since that both and moment, and I've been exploring what that means ever since. The way that looks right now is that I have my own business, which I've been running for about 6 years. It's called Defy the Trend, and I now call myself a burnout recovery coach. So I help people, like the people like me who are change makers, artists, healers, faith-based, faith-based organizers or leaders of some capacity, or just people who quite frankly just care about the world and want it to be better for all people. So I want to work with those folks. I do that by coaching. I can also help do that with like visioning and strategy with organizations who want to be sustainable and who want to make the change they want to make in the world without burning people out, their teams, and they want to do that in a compassionate, humane way with their team. So that's the work that I'm doing now. And like you've helped me tell my story so beautifully. I think people will understand why I'm doing what I'm doing very, very well as they're listening. Hopefully, still listening to this probably too long podcast because I like to talk. So that's what I'm doing. You can find me at defythetrend.com as my main website. You can find me at Nicole Havelka on LinkedIn is my most active place. Blue Sky is another place to find me. I'm not on there quite as often, but that's under just hyphen rest is what you'll find me at there. And I'll tell you more about why that word in a minute. And then I also have a newsletter called Just Rest, on Substack as well, and that's defythetrend.substack.com. And that's the precursor to my podcast you just referred to. As of this taping, I am crowdfunding to help pay for some professional support for the launch of that podcast, which I'm calling Just Rest: Burnout Tips for Everyday Radicals for the people that I just described. And it's going to be cool conversations like these in the messy middle of like people who want to make change and who want to take naps. You know, how do we make both of those things? It's a both and sort of conversation because it's rest is resistance to grind culture, to toxic capitalism, to all of those things. So resting is in fact in and of itself a form of resistance. And so that's what I'm looking to explore with my new podcast, which by the time this airs, hopefully will be a thing. And the place on my website that I hope it will exist will be defythetrend.com/podcast is where I hopefully that stuff will all live by early October would be my guess.
So we'll put all, we'll, and we'll get all the information about that. One of the things that people who are listening to this may or may not know is that, because when we talk about organizational systems management, I think that a lot of people think of companies and the structures and maybe government organizations, but a huge amount of research about organizational systems comes from academic systems and also congregations. Like many of the people who do research on that are actually are do their research on people who are running big congregations, because it is a complicated set of circumstances and one that has all kinds of things going on to it. So that definitely surprised me when somebody handed me a book that was like, this is about organizational management, and the person who wrote it was out of a faith group. And I was like, that is unexpected. Like, so that's the reason I lend that there. Are you ready for the fun questions?
Yes, I'm always ready for fun.
All right. This, I have to admit, this is inspired. This question is inspired by my own experience with youth and Sundays and after church. Okay. If you have a choice between a donut and something like coffee cake, which is your preference?
Coffee cake.
That's totally like every Sunday of my childhood, go to church, go to the basement, get a cookie. The okay.
Coffee cake or donuts, right? That's very church basement kind of fare. You're
I mean,
right.
I right, exactly. That's where my mind was. I totally, that's exactly what inspired that. Okay, so on a hot summer day, when you want a cool and refreshing drink, what is your favorite cold summer beverage?
Oh my gosh, this is going to be a little weird. It's something I'm currently obsessed with because it's really hot right now as we're recording. Trader Joe's has this juice that is cucumber watermelon,
Okay.
and it is so cool and refreshing. It's wonderful. If I don't live in a place that has a Trader Joe's anymore, so that can run out during the, I get there maybe once a month to a city that has one. The other thing I like is the Simply Limeade with seltzer water mix. So you mix seltzer. This is a pro tip, friends. Like Simply Limeade, or you could do lemonade, but I found the lime tastes better. And then get just plain old seltzer water and mix that together with ice is another really good one.
That does sound delicious. We went through a phase in my house that was like 10 years where it was like the Simply Pink Lemonade. So I, that's like, I'm a fan. And the kids were young, so I tried Limeade once with them and they were like, no. Now they'd probably like it, but okay. So when you have a tough problem in your life and you want to talk it through with somebody, who is the person in your life that you are most likely to call or text for support these days?
You know, I am blessed enough to have lots of people in this category, but the first piece person that I thought of is my dear friend Ellis, who is another fellow church nerd who's been with me for a long time through all of this nonsense. And my friend Ellis is similarly frustrated now with the church and is getting there is near is this close to being done with their master's in counseling and is becoming a therapist.
Okay.
So we'll be doing a different kind of work and doing work and change in the community. But the reason I always tell them that I call them a lot is because call or text is because like I know like someone who is both really supportive and who does not bullshit me.
Very good.
Like, will tell me, like, I love people who will just get in my face and tell me when I'm being an idiot. So, and Ellis is one of those people, and I can think of that's like making me think of other people in my lives too, but Ellis was the first one that popped to mind.
That's fantastic. That's it. Nicole Havelka, thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Oh, thank you, Amy, for even having me. This was a delight.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obviously, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.